Hey everyone, welcome to Taking It Down, an Alabama Tape podcast. Thanks for tuning in. On today's pod, we're going to be talking to special friend of the podcast, Kelly Duncan, on the Tarantino film that was just released, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. And then later on, we'll be joined by co-host Adam Morrow, and he and I will discuss the Netflix football documentary series, Last Chance U. And we'll give a few final thoughts on the HBO show, Years and Years, that just finished. So grab a cup of coffee and let's start taking it down. Joining me now is special guest of the pod, Kelly Duncan. Kelly, say hey.
Hey, it's Kelly, quote, slam, unquote, Duncan.
That's her. So we're going to talk about Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, Quentin Tarantino's latest film, sort of the big event movie of the summer, it feels like it to me. So what's your relationship with Quentin Tarantino and his movies?
We always go and see the movies when they come out if we know that they're Quentin Tarantino. And even with this one, you know, I knew relatively nothing about the movie going into it, except that it's Quentin Tarantino's new movie. So we wanted to go see it.
I knew almost nothing going into it either. I remember my first experience with his movies was with Pulp Fiction. We had went to see it. I think we were still in high school even. And we, back then, theaters were pretty lax on whether or not you had an ID to get in. So we saw that, and I remember the scene where Travolta turns with his gun in his hand to ask the guy in the backseat a question and accidentally shoots him in the face. You remember this?
Yes.
Just absurd violence. And we laughed hysterically, and we were the only ones in the theater laughing at that scene. Everyone else was just horrified by it.
Well, that does not surprise me, being that I know that you are slightly demented, but this movie, you know, as with all the other movies, like you said, just the violence is really intense, and I kept on waiting for it.
In fact, that this movie was, it felt almost slow and deliberate, and it was sort of peppered with expectation. Every scene was peppered with this slow build of intensity because you didn't know when that patented Tarantino violence was coming.
Right. And yeah. Even, I don't know how much you want to get into it. Are we spoiling?
Maybe in a minute.
Okay. I'll hold it then.
Okay. This movie was much more Jackie Brown than Pulp Fiction in the Tarantino language. You know what I mean? It was more slow.
It was slow, and you know, even though it was slow, though, each scene was just captivating to me.
Yeah, oh, I don't mean slow in, I'm not trying to use slow as a bad term. I mean, it's just, it was extremely captivating, interesting, everything you wanted to watch and rewatch, but it's compared to his other movies, it didn't have that fast-paced dialogue, those quips, those things that you kind of expect with a Tarantino movie. And it doesn't have the violence until a little later on. So let's just go ahead and get into spoiler territory. If you haven't seen the movie right now, you want to pause, come back, and rejoin us when you have seen it. Because I don't think there's really a way to talk about this movie deeply without spoiling it.
Right. Absolutely.
Yeah. Did you realize it was 2 hours and 40 minutes long?
It did not feel that way. So I didn't know going in, and I honestly didn't know going out until I looked at my watch.
Yeah. I knew that it was a complex film for me because complex films usually do this for me. I love them, but I cannot tell you why I like them. And this was one of those where I loved it, and it took me days before I figured out why I liked it so much.
To me, it was like, even though it was a heavy, I guess if you were to boil down the plot, it was pretty heavy, but each scene to me was a little bit lighter. Like, I liked the characters. I wanted to get to know them. There was a lot of humor in it. I just really liked it. I thought all the way around that it was great.
So for anyone who doesn't know, it's basically 1969 Hollywood, 1969 LA. And Leonardo DiCaprio plays a almost washed up actor, Rick Dalton, and he has a stunt double that he kind of brings with him, who's almost his personal assistant at this point, in his life, and that's Brad Pitt's character, Cliff Booth, right?
Yes, that's right.
And we talked about it. There's almost no violence up until the end. It's these large swaths of film that are so unlike Tarantino, but it still feels like a Tarantino film.
Yes. So I wanted to talk a little bit, and you hit on this. Even though there was literally no violence up to the point at the end, every scene was suspenseful. Like there was the mm-hmm. possibility that violence could happen or that something could go down in every scene. One thing that sticks out to me, which I mean, of course, the Sharon Tate character, we knew going in what her fate is and was in real life, but any scene that she was in, I'm like, oh, what's going to lead up to her murder, you know? And one thing that sticks out to me is the scene of him on the roof, of Cliff Booth on the roof fixing the TV antenna.
Even probably though, sticks out to a lot of ladies.
Oh, well, yeah. But I mean, I'm just talking about like, I'm like, oh, is he going to see something? Is this what, you know, is he going to pick up on something that's happening to her? I was just full of suspense at everything when it ended up that it was just him fixing the antenna on the roof. That was it.
Drinking a beer, smoking some cigarettes.
Thinking about, you know, the time he got in a fist fight on the movie set. So, I mean, it was just, I enjoyed it.
Yeah. The movie is almost a day in a life kind of thing. And then you get this 6 month time jump where Sharon Tate actually is pregnant, which clues you into that moment in her life where something horrible happens. And for those people who don't know, Sharon Tate was murdered by Manson family members, not Manson himself, but Manson family members. And they stabbed her, right, repeatedly. She was pregnant. Yes. It's pretty brutal. And you're thinking, do I really want Tarantino to handle that? He's going to show all of that, right?
I was sitting there thinking, I can't watch that. If this is about to happen, I'm about to have to just take a bathroom break because I couldn't watch that happen.
And as it turns out, it's sort of a flip of that. It's more of a love letter and nostalgia piece. And almost a look at the end of 60s from cinema, from television point of view, and from that idea that Manson sort of ended the 60s. That was sort of the end of the 60s. That and Altamont is sort of the big things that supposedly ended the beatnik peace love movement.
You know, one thing that stood out to me when I was just kind of doing some research after, which, I mean, this movie totally made me want to research after this, which I guess, nerd status, like I'll own it, but I really wanted to go dig deeper into that time period. And one thing that stood out to me is, you know, this Sharon Tate murder and all this that was happening, my dad had just graduated high school. So I would love to talk to him and just see his take on this, what he remembers, you know, about that time period. And then of course about the Sharon Tate murders and the Manson family. I honestly have never had that conversation with him in my 33 years. I'm looking forward to doing that.
And the film turns out to be a big what if movie instead of the Sharon Tate murders. You have the what if she doesn't get killed. It's in the vein of Inglourious Basterds in that way. He kind of rewrote World War II and rewrote Hitler. You know, Hitler gets killed in Inglourious Basterds.
Right. Did you think it was odd that they brought in the anti-Nazi scene in this movie too? Like, do you think that's a fixation for him? I mean, that could
Remind me of that.
Well, it was one of Rick Dalton's jobs. Like they were just flashing back, and he had with the fire gun, not fire gun, whatever it's called, flamethrower. Yes, and he sets all the Nazi people on fire.
So he plays a role. He's an actor, and he remembers one of his roles where he used a flamethrower on set to kill a bunch of Nazis, fictionally speaking. And I think that's just a tongue-in-cheek thing from Tarantino.
Yeah, me too.
A wink and a nod, like, hey, remember I did this.
Right. That's what I thought. Yeah. I thought that was cool.
Yeah, and it's funny. It was a hilarious moment, too. And then, of course, the flamethrower comes back. Right. Since we're spoiling it, we can talk about that part. The flamethrower comes back at the end, and he kind of saves the day with the actual flamethrower that he had on the movie set.
Right.
And again, that comical violence that Tarantino is known for, where he sets a couple of the Manson family kids on fire.
Yeah. Let's talk about the Manson family, especially the scene at the ranch.
Yes. The best scene of the movie. And it's a scene I could watch repeatedly.
So what did you like about it in the scene?
It because of what I was talking about earlier, how it was just any second felt like this is going to go off the rails.
Yes.
what happens was Cliff Booth takes one of the Manson family girls, gives her a ride, hitchhikes. She's hitchhiking back to the ranch, and he knows the ranch owner from just movie stuff. And that, did you know that that's actually true, that the Manson family actually camped out at this old ranch that was used in Hollywood?
No, I did not know that. I didn't.
Also, I'm going to, here's another tidbit. One of the Manson family members, in fact, the one named Clem, who has an appearance in the movie, murdered a former stuntman in real life. That really happened.
Really? The guy with the teeth?
Yeah. So Tarantino's playing with that idea. If you know that going in, you think to yourself,
he's about to die.
He's going to die. Yeah. But yeah. It's what a great, great movie overall. So let's just, is that your favorite scene?
Yeah, I loved that scene. And I just thought that, you know, with the introduction of George, you know, leading up to George, they don't want him to see him. And then the casting of George, he ends up being that dirtbag from Big Love.
Bruce Dern. Yeah.
Yeah. So I thought, he's about to turn on him. What's about to happen? I just thought that the suspense was wonderful.
The original casting was Burt Reynolds, but he died before the movie started.
Oh, my. Ugh.
Yeah. Yeah. It would, speaking of, every actor, and even like extras almost, were stars. Did you pick up on that? Yes,
absolutely. I mean, Lena Dunham, of course, stood out to me there, but also the little girl from American Life, Cat, that we love. She did an awesome job. Even at the party scene, I can't think of the guy's name, who was pointing out the relationship between Sharon Tate and her various
lovers. That's the guy from Billions, the redhead guy.
Yes. And Homeland. Yeah.
Yeah. And he's in it. Timothy Oliphant's in it.
Yes.
In a small role as an actor who works with the Leonardo DiCaprio. With Rick Dalton there, just a great job. But did that ever distract you, how every person was a famous person?
No, I just thought it was fun. I mean, knowing that it's Quentin Tarantino, I'm sure that those actors are like, yeah, I want to be in a Quentin Tarantino movie, you know, no matter how small the role. I thought it was really cool.
Yeah. This feels a lot like Quentin Tarantino playing with who he is as a filmmaker, because he keeps you guessing on what's coming, because you kind of know what's coming.
Right. But, you know, along those lines of keeping you guessing, even after all the things, even after the girl was, you know, attacked by a flamethrower in the pool and the police had come and gone, at that very, one of the very last scenes where the Sharon Tate's friend invites Rick Dalton over, they hold on his character in the gate for just a little too long, and it was almost ominous. Did you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, there's a couple of those final shots that can be read as a scary tone, as if to say, okay, it didn't happen now, but something bad's going to happen sometime. And that's...
Oh, what a killer way to end it. I just thought that, you know, encapsulated the whole thing, what he was going for. Every little piece was just suspenseful. It was really cool.
Which makes me curious, how well does this movie work if you are just a Tarantino fan and you just so happen not to know anything about Manson or the 60 or 1969? Like, would a young audience get this?
I don't know. I mean, it added to me that I knew some of it, some of the history. So I would think it would be enjoyable if you had some kind of respect and love for the 60s, you know, just like you said, the cinematography and the setting was wonderful.
Yeah. This is hands down my favorite Tarantino movie. What about you?
Loved it. And I loved my date. Wink.
Ha! All right, well, we'll wrap it there. Anyway, yeah, so go see it if you haven't. If you made it this far and you haven't seen it, my goodness, I'm sorry we spoiled it, but go see it. I'm going to go see it again, maybe not soon, but definitely when it comes out on DVD. So that's that. We'll take a break and we'll come back with some more. Thanks. Hey, thanks again for listening. If you're a business or another podcast and you'd like to advertise with us, feel free to get in touch. We can be found at thealabamatake@gmail.com. If you have questions, thoughts, ideas, random things you want to say for a future podcast that would involve a mailbag segment, feel free to hit us up at thealabamatake@gmail.com. We're also easily found on Instagram, Facebook, or Twitter. I'm being joined now by Adam Morrow, fresh off the road. Adam, what's up, man?
Fresh off the road. I'm here.
Yeah? How was the road?
Just settling back in. binge watching some. It was good. It was good. I'll be very brief. We all got sick at different points. So that was, it was kind of like the van was just a rolling infirmary. But other than that, everybody soldiered through. It was great.
All right. Good, good, good. Well, we're back and we're going to be talking about, let's start off with Last Chance U, a Netflix show. It is about what they do is they cover a season of football with a community college, started with East Mississippi Community College 4 years ago, and they cover the season that was. And that coach was Coach Buddy Stevens. And what this show, you know, I thought it was just a regular show about football, but the more I watch it, the more I feel like it's touching on some subjects that are pertinent to everyone. It's not really just a football show, which I think we'll kind of get into. Anyway, the show is now up in Kansas with Independence Community College these last 2 years. So it's documenting the 2018 season, and we're in 2019 with a particular guy named Coach Jason Brown. So let's go from there. What are your general thoughts about the show?
Just generally about the show, I think what you said, I kind of got hooked in because they time it really well. I mean, we're both football fiends. We're kind of jonesing this time of year, you know, for those of us in the South, and this is the Alabama take. So I assume most of us are, you know, you start getting SEC media days and then it starts creeping along and you really want your fix. And so the show kind of appeared on Netflix, started in, it's always late July, they intro with, you know, players at practice, the drum line's going. I'm like, all right, I'm in.
Yeah.
I'm hooked. And then you start watching, and it's what you said, where it becomes a much more human show than just covering football. Because at first you're like, well, it's football, and now the second level is, well, all of these coaches are kind of assholes who hold – wherever they are, the town, the community college, the junior college, everything is kind of held hostage to their whims and their personality.
Yeah.
In very, very different ways between the two coaches, but.
And you're really only talking about
the players.
I mean, the two head coaches, I bet, right?
Yeah. Yeah. They're both such personalities, and especially, I guess we'll key in on season four with old JB, Coach Jason Brown. Yeah, I mean, you have kids there, college kids who are, you know, none of them want to be there. None of them are from Kansas. They're trying to go on to bigger and better things, usually from pretty tragic circumstances. And it's all up to this coaching staff and the school to try to do right by them. And that's kind of the rub the whole time.
Yeah, and that's a pretty good overview of all of the seasons. They've only been with two community colleges, and this is with Independence Community College up in Kansas with Coach Brown. To me, it really does get me in the mindset and ready for college football and NFL football as well. It's almost become a tradition these last 4 years. When that show it drops on Netflix, I feel like, okay, it's time to get into start looking at roster, start thinking about who – fantasy football league and stuff like that.
Yep.
It really, I'm all.
It's a good kickoff to the fall.
Absolutely. And it's such a good show. To me, it's an excellent look behind the scenes of that kind of football. Obviously, it's not a good look behind the scenes of SEC football or anything major, but it does get into the psychology of coaching and the psychology of a team. And I think deeper arguments can be made. Yeah. And deeper arguments could even be made about class and race from this show.
I think that's really what it's turned into. At first, it kind of seemed like a bizarro Hard Knocks or a bizarro All or Nothing. You know, one of those NFL films kind of looks behind the scene because these guys shoot so much footage. You know, they're there with them from a few weeks before the season starts until the end.
Yeah.
Just filming. They're in the dorms. They're in the... If you're listening, you probably know how the show works. We won't get into that. But what you're talking about of class and race and all these different things, the collision of, you know, the players either going to a D1 school and getting bounced back for, I mean, some of them are criminal charges, everything from drugs to assault to who knows what. And these coaches convince these little towns and these little community colleges to take these guys in, to take a risk on them. And that's always fascinating. They kind of champion the guy, but at the same time, they're very much the other. And they're almost always a different race, you know, and they're coming from a different background, very different background. You know, there's guys that are from inner city. There's guys that are just from rough neighborhoods of small towns, but none of them are from Independence, Kansas.
Is the one guy named Chase, he's a white guy, is he from Kansas? Uh-huh.
He's from the, and his dad played for the school, right? So he's one of the only legacy players. But there's a lot of, you know, they find, the townspeople find ways to talk about what bugs them about the team without actually talking about it.
Yeah.
You know, like the big controversy this year was, or one of them early on, they're spending all this money putting in a turf field.
$600,000.
Right. And even the way they get the field is kind of indicative of what you're dealing with. Like the field was supposed to go to the Baltimore Ravens, mm-hmm. but it wasn't cut to the right dimensions. And so they just took the leftovers. Basically.
What was it? A quarter of an inch too thick?
Not thick enough, I think was the deal, but that's the show. You know, they're always kind of by the skin of their teeth, especially, this Coach Brown character is such a, you know, he, I don't think a plan is really at the forefront of his mind. He's kind of just rolling with it. But yeah, the tension of, you know, and you as a school teacher, we don't have to get into this too much, but it's frustrating as the son of a school teacher to look at these people who you just realize, you think about the education system that they're coming from and they're struggling with these classes and they don't think they can do it.
Yeah.
And some of them are just self-defeating from the beginning, but, you know, some of them really are just struggling and giving it their best shot.
Yeah, and I do see...
It's really hard to watch.
Yeah, I see it mirrored in my own life, in my own job, and I can pinpoint students who mirror some of the kids on Last Chance U. My well of reality television doesn't go very deep, but I would say that there's not a better reality show that focuses on the socioeconomics of America as much as this show does. Am I giving the show too much credit?
No, I think that they had to know early on, you know, they went to East Mississippi and they thought this is a compelling guy. But the more you hang out there and the more you see this kind of clash of definitely backgrounds and cultures and all this stuff, that's the show. You know, the football has, especially by season four, kind of become secondary.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the episode usually ends, the high point or the dramatic conclusion is a game where they're actually playing, mm-hmm. but that feels more like the game is kind of just the icing on top of this whole thing.
Yeah. And it's good for people who are sort of football fans, not quite, because they just sort of recap the game, give you the highlights. You don't have to wait for the line to shift or the audible to come in or the timeouts. So.
Right. And very well shot and well edited. So it's fun to watch. All the action is really fun to watch.
Yeah. And 2 years ago, this show made my top 10 for the year. So like, I'm sounding like I'm overpraising it maybe, but yeah, it's that good. To me, it is. And this season adds a new wrinkle, which is what does fame do to a coach or a person?
Yeah. The idea of being observed, of they keep flashing to Coach Brown. You know, who knows how much time he actually spent doing this, but sitting at his desk with Twitter pulled up.
A lot.
And kind of scrolling through and saying, you know, oh. You know, the messages that he's getting or the new followers he's getting, whatever it is, it's on his mind.
Yeah. And it's pretty comical because he'll say, I'm going to follow him. And it'll be like whoever, you know, Snoop Dogg or whoever it is that
has
tweeted
right.
at him. It's hard not to, this season in particular, it's hard not to see these guys as kids
I think it's one of the first times it's happened where I just see children instead of grown men in the players.
I think the team trended a little younger this year. I think that's my understanding. Some of the guys, it's their second year, but the ones that they really key in on that have, you know, some of the bigger personalities, what's the defensive lineman, Davis? KD, great personality, but very youthful.
Yes.
You know, and you're rooting for him the whole time. And the guy who's ahead of him, who during the show committed to Georgia, I don't know if he's, what's going on with him now, but, you know, he seemed like a college dude, whereas KD seemed kind of like, yeah, I'm still figuring things out.
He seemed like a 15, 16-year-old kid. He really does.
Yeah.
Same action, same expressions that I would see in those age of kids. So how far are you into it? We might get into some specifics of the season.
We're on to the Garden City episode. So that's I pressed pause on that one to come do this. So that's the fourth episode in.
Okay. And how far? Yeah. So Garden City, where he plays his rival, Coach Sims. Am I right about that?
Right. And they are showing behind-the-scenes stuff with Coach Sims to set him up as kind of the other side of the coin.
Right.
You know, he's very detail-oriented. He has him get out of the bus in a Dillard's parking lot.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Which it sets the scene so well. When's the last time you went to a Dillard's?
12 years ago.
Apparently you still can.
Yeah, who knew?
In rural Kansas, yeah. So he has them out there in this mall parking lot. You know, they're running plays. They're checking their assignments. They're doing all this stuff, you know, in slow motion. But this is life at that level of football.
And he is the other side of the coin from Coach Brown.
Seems to be.
Yeah.
Very, you know, he's not bravado. I mean, he was dropping some MFers, but at the same time, he's going person to person and saying, what's your job on this play? What's your job on this play?
A little more militaristic rather than waiting for them to mess up to yell at him.
Right.
So, and still sort of generally speaking, did you feel that Coach Brown was a little less hot-headed going into this season?
It seemed that he had stepped back a little bit. Mm-hmm. I don't know if he trusts his assistants more, maybe if that's what's going on or what the deal is, but he seemed to try to dial it back just a little bit. But the thing that was striking to me, and this is part of the show, I guess. I feel bad for, you know, dragging this through, mm-hmm. but there is alcohol in a ton of these scenes.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I know that there, if you are engaged in like college football Twitter or college football news at all, you kind of know, so I know something's coming, some sort of scandal, controversy, whatever mm-hmm. is brewing. But it's just a weird, you know, I can't see Nick Saban or Kirby Smart or whoever having their staff meeting with a bunch of beers on the table.
Yeah.
It's just a weird thing. And then the tragic thing to me is not that these adults are doing that. It's that there's these kids who their future, whether it's a good idea or not, you know, the NFL pipe dream, the future is in the hands of these guys that are sitting in Independence, Kansas, kind of just screwing around, you know?
Yeah, there's a real telling scene, and I don't know if you've gotten to this episode, but it'll come as no surprise or spoiler, where they're talking to Coach Brown, and he has a glass with some sort of alcohol, I'm assuming a whiskey or bourbon. And then, you know, they do an edit and it's empty. And telling that of the, maybe the situation, maybe his mindset. And we all know, I think we could drop this. If you're worried, if you're really worried about spoilers and you stay off of Twitter and you don't, so you might want to skip 15 seconds ahead, 30 seconds ahead, but he gets fired, right?
Right.
Yeah.
It's coming.
Yeah. You and I knew about that just from, you know, sort of on the periphery of college football news. We kind of picked up on that maybe when it happened and discussed it briefly. But other than that, I don't know much else. I don't get on Wikipedia and look at their previous season's record or anything like that, because I do want,
right.
Because there's part of it that is the drama of the show. And one of the big, plot points, if you could call it a narrative, is bringing back Malik Henry. What What do you think about that?
I think that there's an interesting thing with Coach Brown, that he's a California guy. A lot of the guys that he brings to Kansas are California guys. And Malik was from California, right? Before he started his college journey. And they're all, it seems like Malik gets there and he's like, man, I can't be here. You know, when he, this time last year.
Okay, last season you're talking about. Okay.
Right. They all, the goal is to leave, to get there and leave. Mm-hmm. And I don't know. It's just, it's a weird thing to watch them all hit this little speed trap or time warp or whatever's happening to these people. You just want to shake them and be like, get out of there.
Yeah.
You know, not that Independence, Kansas or rural Kansas or rural Alabama. I mean, we can't really talk here.
No.
Are bad places to live. But when your dreams are bigger than that, it's weird to watch people go somewhere and kind of stall out.
What do you think about Malik Henry in general? Like even from last season, what's your opinion?
I thought he was kind of, he's a little whiny.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. That was it.
You root for him because he's got an incredible arm, but just the constant questioning of the coaches, which I mean, maybe he's right to do because Jason Brown, obviously not the most stable figure to be calling the shots, but
not the most professional.
No, definitely not.
Which makes for good television, though.
It makes for great TV, but when the quarterbacks don't know who's going to play, or he's kind of like pitting them against each other, or whatever it is, it's bizarre to watch.
Yeah, it feels really weird sometimes to think and talk about this show and realize it's not a scripted drama, that these are actual real people. So I do want to be cognizant of that. But at the same time, Malik Henry last season came off as whiny, but also overconfident and a little bit of a know-it-all.
Yeah, absolutely.
And last season he would do this thing. He was sort of two-faced. He had this dichotomy of being chipper and talking to Coach Brown as if they're friends. And then on the sidelines, when he'd get with the other guys, especially the other quarterbacks, he would say, this guy doesn't know what he's doing. We're not going to listen to him. And I don't know if that's the right way to go either.
No, definitely not. And I mean, some of these guys, you know, I think about Bobby Bruce, right? There's a lot of what has to be undiagnosed mental issues going on. And I say that just like even just depression or whatever's happening, where, you know, if you go to a small town to play football and you're this tough football player, then like getting help for what you're going through cannot be easy. But all of these guys at some point, I think Malik is in there too, anxiety or depression or whatever's happening, one of the elements that makes it bigger than football is this idea of like masculinity and how do they deal with this and how do they press on to like achieve their dreams when, you know, being weak in any way means they get sent right back where they came from.
Yeah. And there's a lot of the players, not every one of them, but there's a lot of them that sort of eat up with that toxic masculinity and it's hindering their progress. And you could tell that that's just so ingrained that that's not going to go away.
Yeah. Or they don't know how to, there's elements of self-sabotage where they, I mean, that's what a few of the coaches said about Bobby, is he was looking for a way to go home, but just couldn't admit to him. He couldn't just walk away on his own. He had to force the issue.
Right. In fact, so much so that episode 2 almost doesn't even focus on football. And you mentioned that earlier. It's all about Bobby Bruce almost.
It is. And it's, you know, you watch the staff members and the faculty around them they kind of set up like a chorus of humanity. You know, the coaches are so tied to the football angle. And they can't, kind of what you said with Malik, they can't speak to the coaches the same way that they can their English teacher.
Mm-hmm. What do you think about her? My wife has talked a lot about this English teacher and not in a very good way. What are your thoughts?
I think that that's an interesting thing. I think she without projecting too much, just sees them as like what you were saying, that they're kids, you know, that are caught in something, trying to get out of somewhere, that she has a lot of sympathy for. I mean, I think that's all the teachers are that way. I mean, what is Kelly's take on her?
She doesn't like her. She thinks that she is, has a high and mighty stance over some of the kids.
I could see that. Yeah. And I think there's also the danger of everybody wanting to take up the mantle of, what was, don't forget to take a pencil. What was her, Miss Wagner?
Oh yeah. Very, very aware of the cameras being on them.
Again, these are real people. These aren't characters. And I think that, you know, to end up as an instructor at a junior college, you've either been through something or you have the calling to help people who are there. You know what I mean? Yeah. Or both.
And I was going to bring up the philosophy teacher, the philosophy instructor as well.
Yeah. Same with him. Be very interested in all of their backgrounds, how they ended up there. But it's tough to watch some of them when that first season at, in Scuba in Mississippi, Miss Wagner kind of just organically developed into one of the bigger characters on the show. Right. It'd be pretty tough if you were on the staff and the cameras show up to not think like, well, I guess they're looking for the new Miss Wagner, the new kind of voice of, humanity,
yeah.
Sympathy for these guys.
It could be as much on the camera and the producers, the cameramen and producers, as much as it is this English and philosophy instructor. But one thing that struck me about the philosophy instructor, he seems like he does not want to get as honest with them. He wants to be more of a friend than a mentor,
for sure.
And
maybe he's taking it as what they need is encouragement. You know, the D lineman, Katie, that we talked about, maybe he just needs to be told, you know what, you are smart, you can do this, more than somebody to rattle his cage, but who knows?
Yeah. So you've gotten to the point where they have shown the drummer from last year, but where is his song for the team this year? Where is his?
That's the, does this come up? I'm desperate to know.
I'll not say anything. I'll not say a word.
Okay. And those kind of secondary characters are what make the show so charming. You know, like what is that kid up to?
Exactly. Well,
what are any of these people? The radio guy? Who knows what he's like? Back slinging beers with the coaches at the barbecue.
Yeah, Jeff Carpenter, the radio. He to me is just the kind of guy I would actually sit down and talk to.
Yeah. They're all fascinating because they go to his house and he says, "I can't believe that this all worked out for me. You know, I get to call radio for something that I loved anyway." And it kind of, you know, you sit there and if you're an Alabama fan, or especially if you're not a sports fan at all, you're like, well, this is ridiculous. Mm-hmm. You know, your identity is tied up in what a bunch of freshmen and sophomores in college do on a football field. But then that kind of calls into question, like, all of sports fandom, you know? Mm-hmm. The house of cards that we live on in that world is so fragile. So it's easy to kind of judge these people from afar, but the more you think about it, it's like, well, we're kind of doing the same thing here.
Right. And and that becomes a big point later in the season, big theme, I would even go so far as to say. You know, they record a lot of family things with the players, a lot of the players' families. Mm-hmm. And I think they do that at the, what do you think? Do they do that at the end and then hold on to them to intercut with their moments throughout the season?
I've wondered that as well. And like when they went to talk to Katie's family, I noticed his dad was just drenched in sweat. And so I actually thought about this. I'm like, well, they caught him at work. Clearly he's standing in his truck. So it's probably summer. So did they go before fall started in Louisiana, or are they following up in the spring?
Yeah.
I don't know.
I don't know either.
That's an interesting, because they have to like edit, you know, and kind of figure out who's going to be the storyline. Who knows?
Yeah. And one other guy I'd like to talk about before we wrap up with Last Chance U, I think one of the more tragic figures this season could be Coach Jason Martin, the defensive coach who lives there in the dorm right next door to the office he goes to. And this is a community college dorm.
Yeah, it's rough.
And he's there with his wife. They're from California, and he's got three kids, I think, all young kids, under five, I would dare say.
Yeah.
And she mentions more than once that they moved from California in hopes that he could propel himself into better jobs, better defensive coordinating positions from this, just like the kids there who are trying to propel themselves into a Power Five school and then the NFL. So
right.
What do you think about Jason Martin?
The same. 3.5 episodes in, and they've already spent a bunch of time with him and his wife and his kids. And we just watched his kid play soccer right before I hit pause. I don't know if it's sad to watch. Mm-hmm. It's not, because they're choosing to be there. Like you said, they're chasing a dream just like the students are. But it's tough, you know, because I mean, he seems like a good guy based on what I've seen so far. His wife seems supportive, but I mean, even when they go to do the first interview, his daughter at that age where doesn't really have a filter, you know,
right,
let slip that her mom cried all the way to Kansas.
Mm, yeah. That's tough.
It's really tough. And you root for him and you say, man, I hope that guy's, by the time he's 40 or however old, is, you know, on staff somewhere that's not a community college. But I don't know. Yeah. I mean, that's the rub with anybody chasing their dreams. It's like, when is it time to throw it in?
Yeah. Maybe Nick Saban can give him a shot.
Come on, Nick.
Well, anyway, Jason Martin, I'm very interested to see where he ends up. I'm almost finished with the series. You're almost halfway. So we're pulling for them, and let's take a break now, and we'll come back and talk about the HBO show Years and Years and give some final thoughts on that. Hey, folks, quick break here. Just want to remind you that we do have the main podcast called The Alabama Take that you can find on all of your podcast providers, Apple, Google Play, Stitcher. So go find that podcast, like, subscribe, rate, review, and as always, subscribe to us, rate, review. It helps get the word out there. The Alabama Take podcast and this one, Taking It Down podcast, the pop culture podcast. We appreciate all your support. Let's get back into it, though. Maybe once for real. Okay, we're back. We're going to be talking about Years and Years, that HBO show, which we covered briefly in our pilot episode. We've got, Adam, why don't you, you're a little fresher on Years and Years than I. Why don't you give me a tweet length recap or a Facebook post recap of Years and Years?
Before we go on, are we going all in on spoilers here?
Absolutely. We're going to spoil the whole season. The season ended a couple week and a half ago or so. So we'll, let's talk about the whole season.
All right. So first episode, as we talked about in our first episode, it begins kind of benign, and there's an English family that has kind of at every social strata at the time, and a baby is born into the family. And they look at the kid and they say, what is your life going to be like?
Hey.
You know, 5, 10, 15, 20 years from now.
Hey, hold on. Go ahead. Something happened. You're bleeding out. We may just have to start from the top on this one.
Okay.
I don't know if that's just on my end or you. So we'll go all the way from the top. Okay.
So the first episode, we talked about this on our first episode, this British family that's kind of represents every strata of British society in some ways. There's a new baby born to the family, to this big extended family. And they look at it and say, what's your life going to be like? As the years go by, they're kind of worried about it. So things start happening. Trump wins a second term as president. There's this local politician named Viv Rook who is elected And at the end of the episode, which everything's kind of simmering in the background and you're getting to know these people, the U.S. drops a nuclear bomb on Chinese-held territory. So that kind of sets everything off. And as the series goes on, there's only six episodes. Banks start to fail. Family members lose their job. One of them falls in love with a refugee, and that starts off a whole subplot that kind of really ends up driving the whole story. But really, the world kind of goes to hell in a handbasket, and it's about this one family surviving. And ultimately, I want to talk a bit about this being a Russell T. Davies thing, but in a very Doctor Who kind of way, the humanity that they discover in themselves and in each other is what ends up defeating this dark time.
Yeah, I agree. You mentioned Russell T. Davies. Talk to me about how this is reminiscent of Doctor Who, which I am not very familiar with. So tell me more about that.
I think when the intro music and some of the dramatic music started for the first time, Natalie and I looked at each other and it was like, yeah, this is a Doctor Who. Well, rather, this is a Russell T. Davies thing. His fingerprints, of course, all over the modern Doctor Who, and now all over this. There's a lot of, you know, I think in British entertainment, you think about like a V for Vendetta kind of vibe to a lot of things where something has gone wrong, the government's corrupt, or greed has driven people to do terrible things, and it's always very kind of shadowy and you're figuring out what's really going on. But ultimately what defeats that is the good in common people. That is usually the theme on a Doctor Who episode, especially the big dramatic ones. And that's kind of what happens here. You have all of these people who make mistakes, who are good people at the beginning and questionable people by the end. People who are very normal and who are driven to extraordinary things. Those themes just come through in spades, I thought. There were moments in this that were tragic and kind of would bring a tear to your eye. And then there were some that made you feel like, you know what, things are not going well in our reality either.
Yeah.
Even outside this show, but makes you kind of believe in the possibility of people being good.
One reviewer had talked about why the show was so effective is because it's confronting white privilege or Western privilege.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why it's a little more horrifying than something else you might see on television in serialized format.
That makes sense to me. What we talked about last time, some of the family members have ended up wealthy and living in London, but the whole family is from Manchester. So they all are, most of the common family events, and so most of the folks end up living back at this estate that they have that the grandmother keeps reminding everyone nobody's put money into the house since the 70s.
Yeah.
And they're on into... I think they're in 2022 in the first episode, and it skips a year every episode. So it's been a while, and they're not rich anymore, though they once were. So that it already sets up that fall from grace that you're talking about. But also the privilege of, you know, you think about the white privilege of the guy going, Daniel going to get Victor and trying to get him back in. That sets up what I think is the greatest scene in the series. What did you think about that?
The scene where they try to traverse between France and England, you know,
that whole storyline. And I know we had nuanced feelings about that relationship, but Victor's plight as a refugee and this guy, Daniel, who is a successful member of British society, trying to confronting a problem that he can't overcome.
Yeah.
That's kind of what you were getting at. Like, white privilege was checked.
Uh-huh.
There's nothing he could do. And then it ends in this scene that, you know, I thought was so well done and so tragic.
Yeah, there is a sense when we watch TV that, oh, this war would never affect me. And I'm talking about news television. Or you think that war won't affect me, or this economic collapse won't hinder my job.
Right.
And this show does a good job of saying it could and it will if we're not careful as a society. And yep. to get more specifically into Danny going to get his refugee lover back into England, which he goes through several trials to do that, it comes into focus that he can't, his white privilege won't get Victor in a plane and get him shipped over.
Yeah, it's all checked. And the crushing reality of, you know, you think about when we look back at history, it's easy to say, well, we knew or they should have known Hitler was going to be this awful guy. Why wouldn't you leave? Blah, blah, blah. So, well, it's not as easy as that, much like what's happening at our border right now.
Mm-hmm.
A horrible situation you're getting out of and then coming here and being turned away. I think they did a great job of illustrating that. And I thought about, you know, even when we went over there over the Christmas holiday, we turned on the news and there were always stories about people being intercepted in the channel trying to come to England. So this is very much real life for them. It's not as, maybe not as dire as they, it's kind of an extrapolated reality, you know?
Yeah. And just touching on the series as a piece of drama, I was not invested in Victor because he felt like a home wrecker, and his character was written arrogantly in a way until this moment happens where they try to cross over into England in a rickety little boat and Danny dies. And that brought Victor a lot of humanity to me, but also I think the way the guy played it, the actor who plays Victor, kind of brought him back down to life and let that death of his boyfriend linger over the rest of the episodes.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Just that moment where they're standing at the boat and Danny takes his shoes off and says, I don't want to get my feet wet. I need to have dry shoes when we get there. It's like, man, you're in a place now where things are moving way faster than that. You know, gotta, and Victor's kind of looking at him like, all right, then it's very much like a Victor, the survivor, versus Danny, who things have been pretty easy for up until that point, that collision. And then it ends tragically, but just the horror of when they're in that boat and the waves are coming and then they start packing more people onto the boat and man,
yeah,
it's rough to watch.
It is rough to watch. That's when they start packing more people in and you realize it's possible that some of the people already in the boat might have to go or make room for them. It gets intense.
Yep.
So we're kind of focused on that one scene. Let's fast forward to the end. What did you think? I got the impression, or excuse me, let me reiterate something here. Let me back up and say that I think the show kind of pulled its punch there at the very end.
The very, very end?
Yeah. I'm talking the last 15, 20 minutes of the show, the series as a whole. It felt as though it wanted to give a prettier picture than the one it set up. It's a very similar problem I had with Breaking Bad, which was everything kind of sort of turns out okay, or things are redeemed, and it didn't feel like that's the kind of show it wanted to be up until then. I don't think it hindered it as much as Breaking Bad was hindered by its ending, but what do you think about the idea that Viv Rook kind of got what she deserved probably, or some of the things kind of worked out? Talk to me about that.
I think, again, not to belabor the Doctor Who point, but a lot of the time a enemy may be defeated, you know, good may triumph, but it's seen as one battle in a larger war. Which I think he tried to do with saying at the end, Edith, right, that is giving her memories at the end.
That's right, yeah.
She says, I'm going to keep chasing her and whoever put her in power. So
it ends with Edith kind of recounting all this because she's going to have her memory uploaded into some sort of computerized water thing. Pretty sci-fi.
The cloud.
Yeah, the cloud. It
turns very, very sci-fi at the end. And I don't know if you meant this, they don't know if her consciousness will be involved in the upload. And you don't know, that's kind of how the season ends. It's a cliffhanger.
Mm-hmm.
who knows if that sets up season two or not, but either way, I don't know how you could do a season two.
I don't think you could. And I think I've read that they're not, that's not going to be a goal.
I think that would be for the best. Yeah. But yeah, that sci-fi angle of, you know, to backtrack a bit to get to that point, you know, they start being able to perfectly replicate people's faces and voices. And so, you know, the word fake news, as much as I hate that, takes on a whole new angle when you can literally manufacture quotes. Mm. So they're kind of dealing with that. And it's, you know, again, it's just like the reality that we live in now and put it on steroids. And that's the reality of the show.
Mm-hmm. Which causes it to be a pretty haunting show overall.
Very haunting.
Yeah, it is. Overall, I really liked it. I recommend the show to anyone. I think your mileage may vary with those last 15 minutes, but I wasn't super let down. I do think that it kind of ended in a way that was unexpected, in a way that it was unexpected, maybe in a bad way, I should say.
Yeah, I think things like the it may say a lot about British sensibility, the idea of the average person or this average family just kind of trudging along and overcoming something, and like the good in everyone overcomes this big thing, even though it does make for a very neat ending.
Mm-hmm.
It's also, you know, that the scene where they're finally able to, you know, and so they overthrow the bad power through information and knowledge, you know, instead of violence. That's like a very idealistic way to wrap things up. I'm kind of with you on that.
Yeah,
and got it, neatly tucked away.
It might be saying more about me that I wanted the tragedy, the doom and gloom ending that was possibly posited in the first few episodes.
For sure. Yeah.
All right. So years and years, though, but we both enjoyed it.
Yeah, I'd give it 2 thumbs up.
For sure. All right. Well, that'll wrap it up for this episode of Taking It Down. Thanks for joining me.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Yeah. Well, we'll see everybody else later down the road. All right. See you.